This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is indeed Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna with you once again here this evening, and another Hall of Fame edition of the program. It is an absolute delight to be joined by tonight's special guest, and can't wait to hear his story. The 82-year-old native of Covington, Kentucky is with me tonight. He was raised in an orphanage in that very same area and would become one of the greatest trainers that the sport has ever seen. To date, he has saddled 2,575 winners, including four Breeders' Cup champions, and his runners have amassed purse earnings of more than, how about this, $125 million. He is a three-time Eclipse Award recipient as the nation's outstanding trainer, and in 1990, he was inducted into Racing's Hall of Fame, and you know I'm talking about trainer Ron McAnally. Ron, an absolute delight to have you with me tonight.
Well, good to be here again.
Yeah, thanks so much. And, you know, your life started, as you just heard me mention, in a very difficult manner. Your mother passed away when you were very young. You and your siblings placed in an orphanage in Covington. Could you ever imagine that you'd be sitting here talking as one of the greatest trainers to ever live?
No, you know, when you start out, you never plan on things like that. You just, in any walk of life, my opinion is, if you do something that you like to do, it doesn't become a job. And I practically grew up around horses. I had two uncles that trained horses, and one in particular, Reggie Cornell, who trained Silky Sullivan and many other good horses for Calumet Farm. But it's been my life, a whole life. I don't do anything else. I don't play golf, tennis, or cards, or whatever. But anyways, it's been a pleasure to be around these animals. You know, when you stop to think about it, they give you so much and so much pleasure, and almost their lives sometimes. And they never expect anything back. Well, you gotta love them, you know, because they don't say, well, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, like young children. But horses are amazing. They just wait for you to do what you have to do in the morning, and then they that's what they're born and raised to do, is for our pleasure. And so that's the best way I could determine it, you know. That and when I was in the orphanage, you know, of course, I had two brothers, two sisters, and her mother died and her father died very young. It's the only place they could send us. And my uncle came along. He's from Canada. He was uncle by marriage. He married my mother's sister. Mm-hmm. And so it was in 1946. And went to New England at Rockingham Park, and started from the bottom up, started walking horses. What they call a hot walker.
When did you kind of have a sense, even at a very young age, that horses might be your thing, that you might want to be around them for a living?
Well, I didn't think about it at the time, but the more I was around them, the more I understood them, and that's how it all became real, you know. And then once I got familiar with them, and then after a hot walker, and then you're a groom, and then you're assistant, and so on and so forth, and then you become a trainer. But when you're around horses and understand them, you know, just, you know, you got to love them because they do so much for us and for our pleasure.
You know, after high school, you went into the United States Air Force and then attended the University of Cincinnati. And if I'm not mistaken, you studied, what, electrical engineering at Cincinnati?
Yes.
Were you thinking maybe of doing something completely different at that point?
Yeah, at that time I got married, you know, I was in the service, you know, and how that goes. It's you get very amorous and got married pretty young, and I wasn't sure, you know, being married, whether it was the right thing to do or not, to be around horses or to learn electrical engineering. Even though I was getting good grades, they were passing grades, but then I got a divorce, and that gave me the opportunity to come back to the track and do what I thought I loved the best, you know. And electrical and engineering was a tough subject, but anyway, it was a lot easier for me when I got around horses and have to think about all those figures and facts, and that's basically why I came back to the track, and then the more I was around it, the better I liked it.
And you said you started with your uncle, or Reggie, right?
Reggie Cornell, yeah, he's from Canada.
Yeah.
By marriage, you know, you married my mother's sister, and then I worked for Reggie for a number of years, and then he didn't really show me what to do or how to do it. I just stood back and learned by observance, and then I went out on my own. I think it was 1950 or 51.
Yeah. You know, I used to love Rockingham Park, and I went there many times when I was growing up in that part of the country. What are some of your fondest memories thinking back on Rockingham and working with your uncle there?
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun. You know, of course, I was a hot walker in those days. I didn't have all the responsibility, and we used to go there, called the Canopy Lake. It was a big amusement park, and we'd go roller skating and have a lot of fun, you know, and just like young kids do, you know, they're just daredevils. And you
tell me about the announcer there. He had kind of a signature call.
I remember Babe Rubenstein was his name, and he would call a race, and sort of like a Silky Sullivan type race where a horse would come from behind and he'd be so-and-so's in front, second, third, you know, and then here they come down the stretch, and they said, so-and-so is coming on like the wind, you know, and I remember him making that statement.
How much time did you get to spend around Silky Sullivan?
Quite a bit of time. I had him as a two-year-old at Hollywood Park. Being broken before he even raced. And Reggie was in San Francisco, and I said, Reggie, we got a two-year-old down there, and he's far better than the others. He said, well, give the others a head start, you know. And sure enough, that's what we do. We'd give him two lengths and then five lengths and 10 lengths, and I think he learned how to run that way. He was a big ham, loved to eat, beautiful horse.
What made him so special? I know he had that big late kick, and that was kind of his signature style of running. What made him so special?
Well, that made him special. Yeah. You know, he'd fall one race here I can remember vividly. He was, I think, 21 lengths behind the last horse, and Shoemaker rode him. And turning for home, he just blew by them. And that's really what made him so popular. He was at the, I don't think I've ever seen a horse drop that far back and came on in the stretch, but what he was doing actually is running his last quarter in 22 instead of his first quarter.
Wow.
So that's what made him special.
When you were growing up, even when you were working with your uncle at Rockingham, were there other trainers that you looked up to and maybe wanted to model yourself after someday?
Not really. I guess Reggie was the one that, you know, it was kind of rubbed off on me, because he never really sat down and showed me how to do it, but like I said, it was just me standing back and observing, you know, the way to do it. And when horses had a problem, that's the main thing a trainer has to do, is recognize horses' problems and to keep them fit. You know, that's their main objective, keeping them fit and knowing when problems develop and what you got to do and things like that. That's the main thing that a trainer's got to do.
Visiting with Hall of Fame trainer Ron McAnally here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ron, how did you know that the time was right to go out on your own?
Well, at that time I was married to a woman, and she said, you can do it. You know, you know enough about it. And she was a good salesman, of course. And there was a man in Englewood who was in the television business. And we claimed a cheap filly called Him at Star. You can look back on the records. That's the first winner I ever had. And I think we claimed her for $4,000. And about a month later, we ran her back for $5,000, and she won by $5,000. She was a little skinny filly, and we used to got her eating good and, you know, nursing along and grazing and put on some weight and got stronger, and that made a difference, you know. And then from then, you know, it was I just kept trying and going, got more clients and doing a lot of talking like, you know, a trainer has to do. And that's basically how it all started as a trainer.
Who were some of those earliest clients that said, okay, Ron McAnally, I will support you?
Well, there was a guy from Mexico City on the newspaper, named Fernando Gonzalez, and he had, I think, 3 or 4 horses. And we did real good with him. And then I got another client that was in the advertising business with Coca-Cola and many other products. He was from back east, and had one horse for him. And it just kept growing after that. And then one of the first big clients I had was Ross Clark here. His wife was named June, and they gave me some good horses. One of them was King of Turf, mm-hmm. And King of Turf was a good grass horse, and he also won in the mud here at Santa Anita. Won the Struve Handicap, beat the horse named First Landing, who became very popular.
Sure.
And then we went back east because of King of Turf being a, you know, a good grass horse, and we went back east and we did the grass racing there, and then it just kept growing after that.
Was there a moment early on in your career when you finally said, hey, you know what, I can do this, I can be really, really good at my profession?
Not really.
I
just kept, you know, doing what I love to do. And I think the first big break I got was Elmendorf Farm.
Yeah.
And Max Clark owned the Elmendorf there in Paris, Kentucky. And he was had a farm manager named Jim Brady. And they had a big farm there and raised 20 babies they'd send me every year, and all of those babies were either allowance horses or stake horses.
Wow.
And they really put me in the Hall of Fame, I think, because of all the good horses I had for them over 20, 25 years. And then along came John Henry, and that was sort of the icing on the cake, I think.
Tell me the story of John Henry and how you were able to acquire him and have him in your barn.
Well, I was sitting here in Santa Anita one morning, and I got the phone call from this man that owned him, Sam Rubin. And he said, we nominated him for a stake here at Oak Tree. And he's a good horse, but, you know, I don't know how good he is or anything. But, you know, he's no special horse. But so he arrived at 4 that morning. And 5 o'clock that night, he ran in a race here and finished second. And I said, boy, this horse is something. Tired as he was, he still ran good. But when they sent him to me, he was a gelding. And they told me that he was very mean and nasty. And so we just got along good with him. The Louis Sinicola, who used to gallop him, he was, sort of gave him his way, you know, and then let him stand there and go to the track. And when he was ready to go, then he would go ahead and gallop him. But we treat him, you know, like we do most of our horses, as best we can.
But at first, they didn't think he was going to be special?
Well, when we ran him that day, the first time out, when he was second, I said, you know, this horse, he's got some ability.
Yeah.
But not dreaming he'd be the horse he was. But as it turned out, we just kept treating him good and being nice to him. And the better we got with him, you know, the better he was running. And he became very competitive in that sense. You know, he was we didn't beat on him, or like I heard the previous trainer used to beat him, and because that's why they gelded him. And so he kept on and on and on, getting better and better and better. And he wasn't a real pretty horse, but. And they never paid a lot of money for him as a yearling. The Rubens didn't own him then, but he had won a couple of claiming races. And then a salesman came up to Sam in New York, which is where Sam was. And he said, you want to buy a horse? And $25,000, and that's how it all started. And then Sam called me and told me, and that's when we ran him, and he ran second. From then on, you know, he just kept getting better and better.
Yeah, I mean, to have him have that kind of success that he had for so long, that's unheard of in this sport, Ron.
Well, that to me, looking back over my life as well as his, I don't think anybody, it could have been Wise Dan if he didn't get hurt, but I don't think any horse will do what John did. He became horse of the year at the age of 9. You know, you take any athlete, you know, Kobe Bryant, Jack Russell, any of these athletes, you know, that when they get older, they start tailing off and going down, not being as good as they were when they were 6 or 7 years old. And I don't think, you know, they beat his money record and all that, you know, with the Breeders' Cup coming along, many of his other records, but. I don't think any horse will ever become horse of the year at the age of 9.
How big of a challenge was it to keep him racing at that high level, even into his 9-year-old year?
Well, like I said before, you know, the trainer's job is to keep him sound, keep him fit for whatever race they're going to run in. You know, we ran him here in San Anita Handicap 1 year. Hadn't run in 3 months. He had pulled a muscle in his hip. And he's carrying 130 pounds, but I knew I had to have him fit. And the one thing about him, he did not like the muddy track. But I told Louis Sinicola, we're working before the first race. The track will be good, with permission, and he's going to work 1 1/8 miles in the mud, which I hated to do, but it was a week before the race, and I had to have him fit.
Yeah.
So we had to do it. He won the Santa Anita Handicap the second time.
Wow.
Like I said, I don't think there'll ever be another horse at the age of 9 be a horse of the year.
What was John Henry's greatest performance, in your opinion?
There were so many. The first Arlington Million was so special because it was on a wet track, and he hated a wet track. Winning the Oak Tree Invitational 3 times. So many races that, the last race he won at the Meadowlands, I told McCarron, who was riding him at the time, I said, Chris, you know, there's not too much speed in there. I wouldn't let him drop back too far. And I sat there at the Meadowlands with Sam Rubin right next to him. And I looked up, and going into the first turn, he's dead last. I said, oh, my God. And going into the far turn, he was still last. There was no speed in the race. Here he comes. You know, like Dave Johnson said, here comes the old man. And So that was another special racer. And he would, you know, and then Chris got off him in the winner's circle. He said, this son of a gun's smarter than I am. He knew when to make the move, and, you know, he just what he had to do. So, anyway.
You know, he was so special. He meant so much to your career, Ron, and I know how fond of John Henry you were. You became very close with him, obviously. But when you do think back on him and you think of all those great performances, what is the one thing that you're going to remember always about John Henry?
Well, that girl right there, she I've got a big picture, you know, at home. That's him looking head on. And Amy Zimmerman took that picture a long time ago with his shadow roll and looking straight ahead. It's a picture that's about a yard tall and maybe probably a yard wide. And the quote that she made on it I thought was really special that fit him. It said, some are born great, others achieve greatness. You know, it's like he was, you know, he didn't have any breeding, nothing to do, and the bloodlines, and he didn't look good, but, you know, some are born great, others achieve greatness, which is what he did.
Yeah, he did in every step of the way. That Arlington Million that you referenced with the BART, remember that one? They have the statue there at Arlington as well, yeah. Commemorating that effort. Did you know that you had... When did you know that you had won?
We didn't know if we won it or not. I'm standing next to Sam, and Sam said, well, I'll just take it, you know, take it, be second, or take it, he wins, you know, and I'll accept either one. He didn't want a dead heat. And as great a rider as Bill Shoemaker was, he made a big difference, you know. Shoemaker, to me, was one of the greatest riders I've ever seen. Got more out of a horse just by tapping him with a stick. You know, he's an amazing guy.
Yeah, Shoemaker, certainly unbelievable. And, of course, Chris McCarron, his longtime partner, somebody else who was pretty darn good.
Yeah, Chris, we rode him beautifully. Of course, you know, I keep saying, telling everybody, it takes the horse, which there's a good example, you know. I think... the worst rider in America, I think, could probably run and win on him, you know, because he knew what he had to do. And yeah, so he was just something special. Wish we'd have a few more like that.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that always struck me about John Henry is that you mentioned carrying 130 pounds, and you had John Henry. I mean, there was Forgo and Kelso and those horses back in the day that would tote that high weight. These handicap races today, it's a much different animal now. You can't even compare the two, can you?
Right, yeah. It's a lot different now because they, the guys, you know, they threaten the secretary, if you put too much weight on them, they're not going to run. So, you know, it brings in the crowd, you know, like, and, you know, I mean, when John Henry ran, he would fill up this grandstand here, Santa Anita, and probably bring as many people as they'll bring in her Breeders' Cup this coming weekend. Just a real popular horse. And, you know, we need more of those in our game. You know, just like in any other sport, you know, you get these champion players, basketball, football, baseball, anything. And it brings out the people to see these special horses run or do their thing. And it was the same way with John. You know, he was a special horse, and he would bring them out.
Has the breed changed over the years, Ron? We hear that a lot.
Oh, it has. Yeah. Tremendous. You know, we as long as I've been around, the game has really changed. Like I said, they need more champions, you know, and one of the things that made him a champion, too, is he stayed around so long. But now the horse is a stallion. They retire them at the age of 3 or 4 because, you know, they can make more money as a stallion than they can, you know, racing. So, in that sense, you know, gelding is one of the ways to go. But of course, he had no breeding, and that's why, you know, they, I don't know if he'd have made a good stallion or not, but this horse we had Candy ride for the crack.
Yeah.
It's a good example, too. You know, it was raced lightly, but Candy ride had no breeding. And but he was lightly raced and retired early because he got hurt. But and now he's making a good stallion.
You know, you've been many times, people will talk about Ron McInerney and they say, well, he's a very patient trainer. And I think with horses like that, especially a horse like John Henry, who races until he's nine, I'd imagine that really did have to test your patience a little bit too, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that it tests your patience, you know. But you know, the way I see it, you know, that's the time that I've been around, the type of owners that you can really do good for is like the Craigs and the Whittems and the Elmendorfs and the Rubens, and these people don't call you and, when are we going to run, and why don't you run them back in 2 weeks, or you know, it's something, you know, they people that are so successful in their own business, they lose that trend of thought. They think you're supposed to, you know, they're like push button. They, you know, you press a button and they'll run, but it's not like that at all.
If for a young person that's looking to get into the game as a trainer today, what advice would Ron McInerney have for them?
Work hard and come out here and love what you're doing. And it makes a big difference because you're out here 7 days a week, and if you find yourself going out and playing golf or playing cards and you can't wait to get out there in the golf course or a number of other things, which I'm not saying is a mistake, but if you love what you're doing and you work hard at it and it doesn't become a job, that to me is what the advice that I could give any young trainer.
Hall of Fame trainer Ron McInerney joining me here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue this visit. Viacoa, Haciana, Northern Spur, Tight Spot. We'll tell you all about them next when we come back here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton.
It's never too early to start talking about the Fasic Tipton Florida sale. Mark your calendar now for this premier two-year-old in training sale on Wednesday, March 4th, with the Under Tax Show taking place Monday, March 2nd. 2014 graduates of the Florida sale include Grade 1 hopeful winner Competitive Edge.
Competitive Edge makes it 2 for 2 here at the spa. Competitive Edge, the winner by 4.5 lengths.
Grade 2 Saratoga Special Hero, I Spent It.
I Spent It, a dramatic winner of the Saratoga Special.
And Blofeld, winner of the Grade 2 Futurity.
Blofeld at the rail. Here comes Blofeld to win the Futurity.
With the 2014 sale boasting the highest average and second highest median of all two-year-old sales, the Fasic Tipton Florida sale is the place to be. Nominations are now being accepted. So log on to FasicTipton.com and nominate today. My visit with Hall of Fame trainer Ron McInerney continues in a moment, right after we look back on some of his greatest moments, and we begin with the greatest of them all, John Henry.
Here they come, spinning out of the turn. Royal Heron has a one-length lead. Majinski Secret, John Henry, like gangbusters, followed by Gotta Del Sol. Down the stretch at the eighth pole, John Henry, like a bullet. John Henry now taking command. Royal Heron gone along the rail in second. Majinski Secret is third.
John Henry's win in the 1984 Arlington Million provided McInerney with one of so many memorable moments in that career, as did Viacoa when she arrived to the distaff in 1989.
Open Mind is gathering momentum, but she is 7 lengths off the lead of Viacoa, who comes for home now, entering the final furlong, and Gorgeous with a bold late run toward the rail. Viacoa is put to a fierce drive, trying to hold on by 2. Gorgeous trying to catch her, running out of ground. Viacoa is got it. Viacoa wins by 2 lengths. And then it was Gorgeous second, Open Mind was closing fast, but she wound up third. And what we thought was going to be a blistering pace was a crawl. 48-4 for the half mile. The distaff turned into a sprint as they turned for home, and Byakoa wins it.
Byakoa would also go on to score 1 year later in the 1990 renewal of the Breeders' Cup distaff, before Passiana burst onto the scene 2 years later to take the event in 1992.
And Passiana has taken the lead under a cool and confident Chris McCarron. It's Passiana in front as they turn for home. Fout is all out trying to get to her. Saratoga Glue couldn't keep up. Light is in with the chance. Magical Maiden is there on the outside. Marling is still in heavy traffic, but it is Passiana running away from them. Four lengths clear. Five lengths clear. Spectacular stretch drive. Versailles Treaty is second. Magical Maiden third. No doubt about the best mare in America. It's Passiana. A spectacular drive. And an affectionate pet on the neck from Chris McCarron, as if he were to say, well done, Passiana. Well done indeed.
McAnally's fourth and final Breeders' Cup win would come 3 years later in the 1995 Breeders' Cup Turf.
As the field nears the top of the stretch, Turk Passer surrenders to Northern Spur, who turns for home with the lead, and France's Freedom Cry to the attack. Then Carnegie running third, Flitch on the far outside is fourth, Tamori is fifth, coming down to the final furlong. Northern Spur, foot to the whip. On the outside, Freedom Cry drawing in closer with the furlong to go. A test of stamina here down to the line. Northern Spur fully extended by Freedom Cry. These two in a test of will to the wire. Northern Spur, yes, he's won it for America. Northern Spur, the winner by a neck. Francis Freedom Cry was second best, and Carnegie was third.
Northern Spur capped an amazing run for Hall of Famer Ron McAnally, and I'm back to continue my visit with the Hall of Fame trainer right after these words. Stay with us.
Hanson keeps going. Union Rags, Hanson, and Union Rags, Hanson. The more they asked, the more he gave, and Hanson, what a thriller.
Eclipse champion two-year-old Hanson. Look for his first weanling selling this November. His sire, Tappet, is the clear leader on the general sire list, which has created more interest than ever in Sons of Tappet. Hanson is the North American Eclipse Award-winning colt by Tappet and his leading money-earning male in the U.S. Visit HansonFoals.com.
For racing coverage from the inside out.
I still kicked away and I thought I really had it until the 16th pole. Amazing little horse.
International English events.
A clear round and under the time limit will get you into the jump off.
And hard-fought Western competition.
Here we go, guys. Let's help him. You bet.
Woo! Tune in to HRTV, the network for horse sports. Online at HRTV.com.
The Daily Racing Form NTRA National Handicapping Championship is coming off the most exciting championship in the event's 15-year history. Virtually every tournament this year on track and online is filling to capacity, and the purse for the 2015 NHC is expected to be $2 million, and there's still plenty of time to join the tour and get in on the action. NHC Tour membership is only $50 and includes all sorts of discounts and special offers on DRF past performance and other products. Go to NHCTour.com today. That's NHCTour.com.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full-card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast every day.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Mm-hmm.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Hope you enjoyed the first half of the program and my visit with Hall of Fame trainer Ron McAnally. We're going to continue that here in the second half of the program. Ron, some amazing stories talking about John Henry in the first half of the show, and I know, you know, how much he certainly meant to you and to your career, but you've had so much success over your Hall of Fame career dealing with horses that have come from South America, and names like Bayacoa and Passiana come to mind. Why is that? Why have you been able to have so much success with those type of horses?
Well, when you have the right people, like, you know, I have a couple of people in South America, some more in Europe, and but the South American connection came with Dr. Poblaski. He's a very highly thought of veterinarian in South America. He's with the Jockey Club. He's very honorable. He knows all about horses, and he's been my big connection down there. He has people there looking out for champion horses, and you know, and also Candy Ride. You know, he was another special horse, and you know, like I said before, it takes the owners who are patient, that they don't tell you when to run, how to run, or where to run. And the Craigs owned this horse, Candy Ride, and very patient people and wonderful people. They, you know, they made it on their own. You know, Sid and Jenny met in the dance studio, Arthur Murray, and there was a diet people that were going under, and they took over that, and then they became famous. But what I'm trying to say is they recognize something, you know, in our business, that that you've got to let a person do what he feels is right. That's why they're paying him. Some of the people that don't, you know, you have a plan all set up, and all at once they come and say, oh, you better not do this. Let's run them here. And that's when everything becomes confusing.
Yeah, just kind of let the trainer do their job.
Exactly. And that's what you're paying them for. But Sid and Jenny were just some of the nicest, wonderful people. We would travel with them. We'd fly to Europe with them, go to parties. You know, they'd always big on birthday parties, and they would give each other a gift. And, you know, we even wound up going to winning the Epsom Derby with a horse that we bought to run in the Kentucky Derby, a horse named Dr. Devious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we flew over there to see him run. We wore the big eye hats and the tuxedos, and it was but just the fun that we had. And they would add one of, they were good friends of Alan Paulson, and they took one of Alan's planes and flew over, you know, maybe a dozen or so people, and picked up all the expenses at the Ritz Hotel. And, wow, you know, the people, you know, that they made it, but they're also spent it. You know, they were very nice to people, and, you know, their big Christmas parties every Christmas down at their house. And I of all the people that I trained for, I think we probably had as much fun with them as we had anybody. And they deserved to do, you know, horses like Passiana and Candy Ride and so many other good horses that we had for the Craigs that were special.
Passiana, of course, a winner of the Breeders' Cup Distaff in 1992. But before Passiana, there was another Argentinian bred that was pretty darn good by the name of Bayacoa, and she won back-to-back Distaffs in 89 and 90. Those were your first two Breeders' Cup wins. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, Bayacoa was a different type filly. She was a real speedball. And where at Passiana, you could do anything, you know, raid her or do anything with her. But Bayacoa was the type of filly that, like the race in New York, when she won the Breeders' Cup against the Gopher One, who it was just a terrible thing to see Gopher One break her leg at the eighth pole. And, yeah, and I was there sitting with Ted Bassett. And he said, so they interviewed me, you know, down in the winner's circle, Jim McKay. And Jim said, well, how do you feel about it? I said, it's a bittersweet, because I know the owner of Gopher One, and I know how she must feel. And they were very big in the racing business. I said to Ted, you know, just like I told you a few minutes ago, these horses, they give their lives for our pleasure and expect very little back.
Yep.
So Ted says, come on. He said, so we went down in the tent and back of the grandstand. I still had tears in my eyes. And so we had a couple of drinks together and I kind of relaxed a little bit. And we've been friends a long time with the Bassetts. Going back to another Breeders' Cup with Northern Spur, and Ted and Charles Seller were very good friends, and both of them are. Ted was scheduled to present the trophy in another race, but he switched it to, and I have a big picture at home of the two of them standing there crying in the winner's circle, hugging each other. Wow. That was one of the big highlights of Mayakoa. And even today, when there's occasion, well, just a couple of weeks ago, when here in Arcadia, they have plaques on the sidewalk, like, you know, Horses Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lining the sidewalk. Yeah.
Yeah.
It goes for miles, too, doesn't it?
Yeah. And Lafitte got up there, and for unknown reason, he said, the best filly I ever rode in my life was Mayakoa. He made her special. So, anyway, and then back to Pasiana. She came very close. She got beat a nose here at this track at Santa Anita by a Hollywood Wildcat. And another jump or two, she's going to win. But otherwise, she would have won it twice as well. So, anyway, those are some of the memories that I have about those two fillies.
You've had so many great fillies. And, you know, even I was at Arlington Park a couple of years ago when you arrived with Eclair de Lune in the Beverly D, and that was in, 2010. And you trained her for Richard Duchessois, the chairman of Arlington Park, and the Beverly D named in honor of his late wife. And I can imagine how emotional that winner's circle must have been.
Oh, yeah, and that's the first time I've ever seen the crowd at Arlington Park, you know, give him a standing ovation. And Dick was actually crying. Dick now is 93 years old, and he's he and Ted Bassett, to me, and Charles Seller, are the three biggest ambassadors to racing I've ever seen. They've done so much for racing. All the years I've been around, they are. The best.
Yeah, they get it. They're people that understand the sport and give back to the sport, and I think that's so important.
Yeah.
Ron McAnally here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ron, let's turn the calendar to 1990 and your induction into Racing's Hall of Fame. Tell me about that day and what comes to mind when you look back on it.
Well, I was there at Saratoga, you know, and Max Clark was sitting there in the audience, and I, you know, of course, you make a speech, and I got up there, and of course it was very emotional, and it was something, as we said earlier, you know, when you start out, you don't expect anything like this, of which I didn't, you know, even the Hall of Fame, I didn't even think about it. But I told the crowd there, it was through Max Gluck that put me there, because he, Max, you know, not only a great friend, but he knew the right people to hire, like Jim Brady. Jim was, to me, a workhorse, and still is today. We were friends, and I always see him in Kentucky. And Jim was a type of person who works very hard, like we have an assistant now, the same way. And, you know, nothing like hard work to be successful. And if you're doing something you like, it's not a job. So, but Jim was instrumental. You know, it's you gotta give the right people their opportunity to do it. You know, and of course Jim was behind the scenes.
You know, a lot of people, if I ask the question, who is the greatest trainer that you've ever seen? There's going to be a lot of people that will say Ron McAnally. If I ask Ron McAnally, who's the greatest trainer you've ever seen, What's your answer?
I think, to me, Whittingham was. We were very close friends. Charlie had a lot of friends. But even, you know, he had a chance originally to get John Henry, and Sam Rubin came up to him in New York, was something I heard, you know, after. And he said, I've got a horse I want to send out. And at the time, Charlie had a lot of good horses. And, you know, he said, well, you know, go ahead and send him, you know, just like a, like it was just another horse. And, well, you don't do that with Sam. So the guy that was training him back there at the time was a very close friend of mine named Lefty Nickerson. He and I, Ellen Jurgens, were three of us were very close. And so Lefty recognized, you know, we were friends, and he told Sam, he said, why don't you send him to him? The phone rang here at the barn in Santa Anita, and he said, I've never met you before, and I told you earlier we're running a horse there. He's no great horse, but, you know, you want to train him. I said, sure, send him. So, anyway, but back to the Hall of Fame. You know, you practice the speech and practice and practice.
How many times did you practice it?
Yeah. And you get up there and you lose all the, you know, just. And I asked Shoemaker later on, I said, Bill, what do you do? He said, don't practice any. Get up this year and let it flow. So from then on, he taught me a lesson in that too, like many other lessons. So, yeah.
Many lessons. What's the number one lesson that Shoemaker taught you?
I don't.
Hard to put it at the top of the list.
Yeah, we both got started, by the way, at the same time here in Santa Anita, and I was mucking stalls and he was mucking stalls, and he started from the bottom like I did, and I went and did 2 years in the service, and I came out and I said, I'm thinking to myself at the time, I said, why isn't that guy on the top of a horse? He's so little. And when I got out of the service, I came here in Santa Anita, and I went to the paddock, and I said, and all you could see is Shoemaker, Shoemaker. And I looked at him, and I said, here's a guy with mucking out stalls at the same time I was. But Shoe would get so much out of a horse by doing nothing. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what made him so good.
His hands. He had the feel of a horse. And if you go back on Shoe's record, I guarantee it, probably about 80-85% of the horses he won with were riders that would gun him out of the gate, but he let him relax and do that last part more than the first part. And that's the kind of rider Shoe was. He was just unbelievable.
Visiting with Hall of Fame trainer Ron McAnally here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Ron, what is the key to being successful in this game for a long period of time?
Your love of the business, you know. It's just like Charlie, and he was 86 years old. Charlie would be the first one to hear in the morning and the last one to leave. And that showed his devotion to the game. Peggy, his wife, used to say, well, we'd go out on a trip, you know, and you'd go here and try to relax. It'd last one day. And Charlie'd come back, you know. You know, we have a home down in Rancho Santa Fe, south of here, a nice area, and we'd go down there, and invariably I'm down there one day, and my wife will start on me, and the minute we get down here, you want to go back. And so, you know, it's just something that, you know, I can't sit still, and, you know, not. I just love to be around him, watching, running a horse or something, you know, that I watch it on now on television every day, and part of my whole life.
We're sitting here now at Clocker's Corner here at Santa Anita, in one of the truly great settings for morning workouts that you'll find anywhere. You're here every morning. Would you be here even if you weren't training horses?
Good question. Probably if I were able, I'd be out here. But if I weren't able, of course, there's no way I could come out. But,
yeah.
But It is a beautiful setting, one of my favorite tracks. Del Mar is another one. Belmont. Those tracks are, you know, what racing is all about.
Ron McAnally on Trainer Talk. Ron, when you think back on this career, what's the one thing that you are probably most proud of?
Probably getting in the Hall of Fame. Of course, that had to be special. Winning the trainer's title three times, you know, special. But, you know, looking back, you've got to have, you know, like my wife, you know, she's behind all of it. You know, I wasn't successful until I met her. And, you know, it's a situation where she can let you do your job. She has work to do at home and taking care of her houses and the property that, you know, we lease and rent out. And I let her do her thing, and I do what I do best. But she was smart enough to realize that, and that's why I think we were where we are now.
You take the very special person. My wife is cut from the same cloth. This is a sport that takes you away from home an awful lot, and it requires 24/7, 365 days a year dedication, and it takes a very special woman to be able to do what you love so much and do it every day.
Yeah, it's you know, a lot of people don't realize that, but if you have a wife that's nagging at you all the time, when you're coming home, what are you gonna do? Help me do this and do that, and come on, let's take a vacation. Let's go for a 2-week boat ride, or you know. But we did, you know, in the very beginning, before I had a lot of horses, we did have a lot of trips together and went to Europe and South America and the Far East. And we had, you know, a lot of good times together. That was before, you know, we had a lot of horses. And we don't do much traveling anymore. First of all, we're both getting old, and we feel... once in a while she gets after me. We've got to take some time off.
Horses keep you young, though, don't they?
Yeah.
Being around them every single day, for sure. Outside of the big-name horses we've talked about, John Henry, Biakoa, Passayana, even Northern Spur and Candy Ride, what are some of the other horses that you've been around that you're just never going to forget?
Well, Elmendorf had so many. We had Syncopate. He was a big, strong horse, and good at seven furlongs, and he was had a real bad knee, but he every time he'd run he'd win and come back lame. And we had Drama Critic, a real good flop-eared filly that we had for Elmendorf, really great filly. You know, so many of them that, you know, I've really totally forgotten their names sometimes. You know, you can't remember them all, but those ones that are special, you even some of the ones that are special, you can't remember. The older you get, you know, the more you forget. And so if I sit down and, you know, oh, yeah, I trained that horse. Anyway, especially at Del Mar, I think we won more stakes at Del Mar. We had a little filly, Broker Maiden, first time out in a stake at Del Mar that was owned by Elmendorf. Her name was Beauty R.
Okay.
And, you know, those are, you know, things you remember.
How about your, I won't call it your greatest training job with a horse, but maybe your most memorable training job where you've really had to apply all your skills and that horse turns out to be maybe even better than you expected?
I told you earlier about the mud that I had to keep John Henry fit to go a mile and a quarter with 130 on him and work him in the mud. I held my breath then when he worked in the mud because I, you know, he didn't like the mud, and you know, but I had to work him to keep him fit. So I think, and after not running for 3 months and winning the Santa Anita Handicap with top weight, probably the most memorable training job that I had done, you know, just to, as part of the game, and there were a few others, but that one's the most memorable, I think.
What do you remember when you got the news about John Henry being gone.
Well, it was really sad. I knew there'd be a big empty stall. We had him at Del Mar, and this, we couldn't get rid of this filling in one leg. So I got a call from Ted Bassett, and call from Marge Everett, call from Santa Anita. Can you get Mr. Rubin to retire that horse here at these tracks? Or I think Ted Bassett was the most instrumental. And he said, we got a horse park back here. John Y. Brown, I think, was governor at the time. And John Brown said it was a big elephant, wasn't going to work, the Kentucky Horse Park. And Ted, to me, made the most sense. He said, I think it would bring in people to retire champions here. And he's only 10 miles away from the rit where he was born. And I think it'll bring people in more interested, you know. And then he said, I have a deal. I can get all of Calumet's trophies to put on display down there. And Ted, to me, made the most sense. And so, you know, we were good friends, like I said at the beginning, and still are. And I think he made the most sense, you know, because John, you know, would be here in the back there with the trotters, or at Hollywood Park, and they're now closed. So I thought, you know, it's a good place. He was close to where he was born. Yeah. So anyway, we got him there, and it did make a big difference in the horse park.
How about the day you got the news that John Henry had passed?
Well, of course, we knew it was inevitable. It was going to happen because, you know, 33 years old, that's, you know, it's pretty old for a horse. You know, even Cigar, I think he went till he was 23, 25. But we knew the time would come, and finally it did. And glad they buried him there at the horse park, where it was close to where he was born.
Have you gone there to the gravesite?
Yes, oh yeah, we go there every time we're in Kentucky.
Yeah, it's got to be special.
Yeah, yeah.
Ron, when you think back on your career, what do you want people to remember about Ron McAnally?
Well, I want them to remember that I did the best I possibly can for the time I was here. Everybody is born to die, and it's inevitable.
Well, you're a long way from that. Let's. Yeah.
Well, you never know. It could happen today, tomorrow. But anyway, it's just remember that that I was did the best I could for what I was here for.
You've done it very well for a very long time. You're a class act, and I know you probably view yourself now very much as an ambassador for the sport, and that's a great role for you now.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Can't thank you enough, Ron. It's been an absolute delight to hear your story, and a lot of fun to catch up with you. Thank you for taking all the time. I know you have a lot of things to get to, so thanks so much, my friend.
Okay.
Really
all
appreciate
right,
it. Hall of Fame trainer Ron McAnally here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Wow. If you missed any portion of the show, you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast will be available later on. Make sure you do that. Make sure you join us each and every Wednesday night, 6 to 7 Eastern, here on Trainer Talk, all presented by Fasic Tipton. And again, you can go back and listen to all of the podcasts of every Trainer Talk show on our website, horseracingradio.net. So much fun. Ron McAnally with me here tonight. And boy, you talk about somebody who has done things the right way from day one. It is Ron McAnally, no doubt about that. My thanks to Ron. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, doing a great job in our Lexington studios. Until next week on Trainer Talk, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.